founder in the field of social epistemology, self-described as a veteran of the science wars, published more books and articles than I can even begin to list, but if you go to his website then you'll see them all in full glorious technicolor also. He's also created his own controversy in his recent work on Thomas Kuhn. Thomas Kuhn's Philosophical History of Our Times and Kuhn vs. Popper, two books that came out recently, and if you haven't read them, then I do strongly urge you to go and have a look. And today he's here to talk about whether sociology can, in fact, meet the biological challenge.
Okay, thanks very much, Amanda, and thank you all for showing up. And in particular, I'm very pleased to see a young crowd, because in a sense what I'm talking about has to do with the future of social science in light of what's happening now. And in a way, this is related to a book that I'm currently finishing called Reimagining Sociology. The title was actually given to me as a kind of a model on the sociological imagination of C. Wright Mills from 40 years ago. But this text is not really kind of as methodologically driven as Mills's was, but rather it sort of raises the issue about whether social science is losing its subject matter to other disciplines, okay? And to give you a kind of reference point for where we begin here, there's a website, www.edge.org, okay, which is a website devoted to what's called the third culture. Now, as you know from C.P. Snow's lecture, from 1956, right, there's the two cultures problem of the humanities and the natural sciences and how they're sort of separate from each other. Very often social scientists like to think of themselves as the third culture. And in fact, there was a book written in 1988 by Wolf Lepenies talking about how the social scientists sort of emerged in this kind of fashion in the 19th century. But in fact, what's called the third culture on this website, which is a creation, first of all, of a literary agent, John Brockman, who in fact is a literary agent for some of the best-selling science popularizers on the market today, including people like Richard Dawkins, Steven Pinker, Stephen Jay Gould, so in a sense he's sort of very non-sectarian about this, and also some of the people in physics as well. What this site, and it's a very, very elaborate site, and in a sense, part of it is kind of public relations for forthcoming and already published books that he's the agent for. But what it is basically an attempt for humanists and natural scientists to sort of come together and develop a sort of public front in the absence of social science. And one of the things that's very striking here is the extent to which social science does not figure. And what these people have in common who are promoting this idea of a third culture is the renaissance of the idea of human nature, okay, which is something that the social sciences, in a sense, you might say part of the history of the social sciences has been a sort of continual attenuation and even debunking of the idea of human nature. Now, those of you, if any of you follow the literature in sociobiology or evolutionary psychology or any of those kinds of interdisciplinary fields, there is a kind of a stereotype of the social scientist that's promoted, and it goes under the initials of SSM, Standard Social Science Model. And the idea is that social scientists believe that basically everything can be explained in terms of environmental differences. Right, so in other words, whatever is innate or genetically constitutive of human beings as a species is black boxed and not considered part of what explains what human beings are about. Rather, you just explain things in terms of environmental differences. The idea of the third culture is to sort of combat this view, which is taken to be sort of defining of social science. Now, this view, if those of you who've read Steven Pinker's book, The Blank Slate, right, in a sense, that's kind of the most articulated opposition to this, but you also find it in books like E.O. Wilson's Consilience, which came out about 5 or 6 years ago, which is, again, an attempt to unify all knowledge, where there's a sort of pincer attack from the humanities and the natural sciences against the social sciences. The social scientists are seen as the bad guys here. I stress this, I keep on mentioning the humanities here, because in fact there are a lot of humanists who are in fact very sympathetic to this kind of renewed conception of human nature that we're talking about here. Okay, and in fact somebody like E.O. Wilson in his book Consilience, that book was originally a series of lectures, so-called Phi Beta Kappa lectures, that are given across liberal arts colleges in the United States, okay, where the audience is primarily kind of a humanistic audience, right? And here's Wilson saying, look, all of you guys, you know, who have been studying literature and philosophy and history looking for, as it were, the perennial defining features of human nature, and this is why you identify the great books, for example, we biologists are beginning to come up with, as it were, the genetic substructure that, in fact, explains that perenniality. Right, so again, you know, there's a kind of direct alliance being made, circumventing all of the cultural, social differences and things that have been sort of definitive of the social sciences. Okay, I think this is quite an interesting development, and there's a sense in which, if one were to just think about this as just a development within the natural sciences, as just an instance of biological imperialism or something like that, you'd be missing the point. Because there are a lot of humanists on board with this. And those of you who know something about the history of the social sciences will know that there's been a lot of hostility between humanists and social scientists from the beginning. Okay? And here I think it's very important to think about what the humanities means in this context, and in particular what the humanities meant before the social sciences existed. Because I think nowadays there's a sense in which the humanities, of course, obviously have been influenced by the social sciences, and so you end up getting these very hybridized fields, and I'm thinking in particular of cultural studies. But that's not really very characteristic of traditional humanities. Traditional humanities is very much a sort of great books idea, where there's a sense in which if you want to understand, as it were, human nature, you look at the best of what human beings have done. Right? So you don't just look at any old nonsense that any old person's done, you look at the stuff that's lasted. Okay, and in fact, this influenced the history of all of the humanistic disciplines, and it's been a long, hard-fought struggle that's largely been won through the efforts of social scientists to actually, you know, say that we need to consider a sort of broader spectrum of the actual human race in order to understand what human beings are about. Okay, because if you go back to the 19th century, right, even if we're looking at a field like politics, Right. What is politics about? It's about the great men doing the treaties, giving the great speeches. It's not about regular folks. Okay? And what's literature about? Literature's about Shakespeare and Goethe and Aeschylus and people like that. Right? It's not about ordinary people talking about ordinary things or popular plays or anything of that sort. And in this respect, cultural studies has made some very serious inroads into the humanities. But the point is, the default position for the humanities was always this idea that there are some very perennial issues about human beings that in a sense get expressed in some ideal, typical, or very explicit or very clear way in certain kinds of works. So in other words, difference isn't really recognized except as a kind of noise to what's in fact essential to human beings. And that's why you always want to go back to the great works. Okay? And it's that kind of sentiment that's very much rooted in the humanities that is hooking up with a lot of this kind of human nature stuff that's going on in the sociobiology and evolutionary psychology stuff. Okay? So the point here is, just because one is humanistic, it doesn't follow that they're necessarily going to be relativistic or culturalist or any of that kind of stuff. Because in fact, historically, the humanities have been the bastions of a very aristocratic way, you might say, of understanding what human beings are about, which dovetails with what a lot of these evolutionary psychologists and sociobiologists are talking about. Now, when one thinks about the social sciences and about their distinctive contribution to knowledge, okay, I'm going to raise some things here that, in a sense, you might consider incredibly obvious, but nevertheless, I do think need to be raised in the context of what we're talking about here. And the main point is that the social sciences, from a methodological standpoint, are actually quite innovative because the inquirers actually interact with human beings. Not texts, not books, not remnants, residues, artifacts, but with people. And this applies both to the qualitative and the quantitative side of the discipline, because you can't do all those massive quantitative censuses and all these other demographic things that have been quite characteristic of the quantitative side of social science unless you're actually knocking on doors and looking at things and then making little checks on your list of the different categories you have for classifying stuff. So you actually have to go out there and deal with flesh and blood human beings. Now, this is an amazing innovation from an epistemological standpoint, because if you're a traditional humanist, the way you understand human beings is by reading the best stuff they've ever done, and not even and don't talk to anyone except your fellow humanists. Okay, and in this respect, there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, humanistic scholarship is a very solitary and lonely kind of trade, and all of this. Now, you see this, but from a social science standpoint, this is weird. If you want to understand human beings, you study them, you go there, you look at them, you interact with them. Okay. But this has not been the traditional humanistic way of dealing with things. Okay. Now, on the natural science side, the interesting thing, of course, is a lot of these natural scientists, especially today, the evolutionary psychologists, the sociobiologists, people of that kind, are interested in understanding what human beings are about, and this is why they create these hybrid sciences. But they, in a sense, don't think you need to necessarily look at human beings either. You could be looking at primates, you know, other kinds of primates. You could be looking at other animal species. And in fact, you don't even have to look at them in the whole. You don't even have to be sort of ecological about it. You could be just looking at their genetic composition or bits of them. And insofar as they overlap with things that human beings have, it is taken as given that you're saying something significant that applies to human beings as well. So the idea that to study human beings, you actually need to interact with them, is not necessarily part of what the natural scientists are up to in this project either. Now again, you might think, wow, you know, this is pretty amazing, right? I mean, and in fact, one of the reasons why social scientists tended to come up with this view that gets stereotyped as the standard social science model, right, where your environment is what makes the difference to what you are, is as a result of interacting with people and where they live and getting a sense of what they're about. It's that kind of information that leads one to come to that conclusion. So that's a very sort of interesting kind of point. And there's an additional kind of point on top of this, and this has to do, because all of these social science projects that over the last couple of centuries, basically, that have been involved with actually interacting with people and getting to know people in some sense, you know, by listening to them or looking at them at least and marking them that way, have typically been connected with policy projects, right, in terms of you think about who's, especially these larger scale things, who's funding them and so forth. The idea of getting some kind of organized or systematic understanding of human beings, typically having to do with nation building perhaps, or some sort of larger scale kind of activity. So there's a kind of political motivation there, and the political motivation, whether or not it's explicitly democratic, and sometimes, you know, maybe it's not, nevertheless operates on the assumption that you need to take into account how each individual thinks or how each individual, what they believe. Because that's going to matter in terms of whether governance is going to be effective. Again, you see, now if you think about studying human beings in that fashion, right, you can't avoid the question of democracy. The question of democracy is always looming there in some fashion, right? Because there's a sense in which each individual matters. They're not just a representative of a species, but as it were, as individuals, they matter. And this is true of both the qualitative and the quantitative side of social science. And this is where there's been a tendency that the more social science research that gets commissioned and gets done and so forth, the more there's a kind of democratic empowerment payoff to that. Okay? And so when one looks at these attempts to kind of pull away from social science and to try to make generalizations and conclusions about human beings based on studying things other than human beings or not studying human beings in the whole, then one wonders what's going on from a political standpoint here, right? So there's a kind of an interesting movement. And those of you who've had a chance to look at Steven Pinker's book, The Blank Slate, one of the themes that runs through this book, it isn't just a matter of that it's empirically false to just focus on environmental differences as determining human behavior, but there's also the problem of that it leads to unduly high policy expectations, right? Namely, if you change the environment, you'll change the people. So if you want people to behave one way, just rearrange their environment and they'll do what you want them to do. I mean, somebody like B.F. Skinner, if you remember 35 years ago now, he wrote this best-selling book, Beyond Freedom and Dignity, right? And, he did Walden 2 and all these other sorts of books. And he was putting this standard social science model in full-blown, very explicit, as a way of saying, look, you know, we can kind of be whatever we want if we just change the environment and change the, as it were, the reinforcement schedules, as he called it, right? By which the operants being your sort of spontaneously generated behavior, you can just mold them in various ways and get people to do all kinds of stuff. And then you can figure out what kind of society you want and then get people to behave accordingly. Simple as that, okay? Steven Pinker's point is, the problem with that isn't that it's authoritarian, because that was the old problem with Skinner, right? People thought, oh my God, is it going to be like an authoritarian regime? No, that's not the problem. The problem is it doesn't work, right? The problem for Pinker is it doesn't work. Namely, there's a kind of recalcitrance, resistance, resilience that has to do with, you know, whatever, the genetic composition of human beings ultimately. That means that they're not infinitely malleable into whatever kind of policy scheme you want to get them into. Okay, and so Pinker's point in all this is going to be that we've got to scale down our policy expectations, and that we have to sort of realize that people are kind of the way they are, and we can't try to get them to be things that they're not going to be able to be, just because we know that genetically they're sort of limited. Moreover, not only are they limited, they are also differentiated in ways that makes it very difficult to have kind of uniform policies about anything. Okay, and that's a point he stresses very much, especially when discussing issues of intelligence. Right, because one of the ways in which Pinker thinks of himself as kind of a progressive guy on these matters of the genetic basis of intelligence, for example, is that the old guys basically thought that there is some kind of like absolute cutoff point. You know, you have like a normal distribution curve, and you've got you want to maximize the people on the high end, and you don't want anyone on the low end, and it's a straightforward story. And Pinker's saying, no, it's really quite much more variegated. There are many different standards one could be using, and one has to be sensitive to that, which means you can't have a uniform policy about slotting people and stuff like that. And so what you end up getting as a kind of, you know, what's the overall conclusion is, you basically get this idea that there's not really a lot that politics can do to improve the human condition other than minimize the worst possible outcomes. Okay? And this is quite a theme, you know, this is a theme that runs through a lot of this kind of literature that I'm talking about here. Namely, that the myth is to think that one can actually reach a point that goes beyond what normally happens, but what one can do is one can sort of, as it were, provide a safety net so things don't get too bad. So it's a kind of notion of welfare that's aiming at minimizing suffering rather than maximizing good. Okay, and that's kind of, and another person who's very explicit on this point is Peter Singer. Okay, and I think in a sense, if you want to get a view about how, you know, sort of the Weltanschauung has changed in the period that I've been in professional academics. So, you know, I started, thinking of myself of having an academic career now about a quarter century ago, which is a long time. And I think one of the things that has really changed over this period is the degree to which somebody like Peter Singer is taken much more seriously now than he was in the very beginning when he was seen as kind of a weirdo. Animal liberation and all this kind of stuff back in the 70s. But now this is quite a serious option, and in fact it's been sort of rolled into a lot of other kind of apparently progressive ideas, including development policy and things like this. And as you know, maybe that 5 years ago, Peter Singer wrote a small book called For Darwinian Left. And there he made the argument extremely explicit about the kind of purchase that this kind of view that I'm talking about would have, namely that for progressive politics we should replace Marx, who's a person who in the past Singer himself had endorsed, with Darwin as the sort of foundation for leftist politics. And Marx in this story, and I recommend you have a look at this book, Towards the Darwinian Left, because it's like a pamphlet, it's a short book, maybe 70, 80 pages long at most, is that basically Marx is portrayed as sort of a victim of the standard social science model. And one of these guys, in a sense, no different from Skinner, who basically says, you know, you rearrange the environment, you can rearrange the way people are. Okay? And Singer says, well, look at what happened to the Soviet Union, look what happened to communism, look what happened to socialism more generally. You know, things just don't change that fast or that deliberately. There are a lot of genetically based constraints that really kind of prevent all this kind of change from happening. And so you got to be more realistic, okay? And this being realistic is a business of scaling down expectations. And Singer is quite willing to scale down expectations to a considerable extent. So those of you who have feminist sensibilities, I recommend you read this book, because Singer decides to give you a kind of evolutionary psychology explanation for why it is that women can't quite reach to the very top of chief executives of corporations and so forth. No matter how many incentives, no matter how much affirmative action, no matter how much of that sort of stuff is done, right? Why is it that women just can't quite make it? And he says, well, it may just be that we've reached a kind of biological barrier here, given the centrality of women to reproduction, and reproduction is the key causal mechanism in the Darwinian scheme of things, right? I mean, it sort of functions the way class struggle does in Marxism, right? Reproduction is where the action is. And you're obviously going to need women for that, and so you don't want to pull too many women from that process, because otherwise everything just would go to hell. So the fact that women cannot quite make it up there, no matter how much, efforts are taken by the state to try to correct disadvantage, is a kind of biological barrier. He says he doesn't want to say he knows this for sure, but he wants to say we need to take this seriously. I think, for someone who calls himself, you know, progressive, leftist, and so forth, that's pretty amazing. And it gives you a sense of the way in which the center of gravity on these kinds of discussions have shifted. Right? Because this is now taken as a serious possibility. Okay? Again, I don't want to say that everybody's a biological determinist, and in fact, these people don't talk in terms of biological determinism. Right? I think a very important thing about this is to appreciate the nuance of this kind of position we're talking about, because it's a position true to the sort of neo-Darwinian view that recognizes variation. But the variation, you know, there's a difference between variation and changeability. Okay, and I think that's a very important point to keep in mind, because especially very much in the cultural studies arena and so forth, there's a tendency to valorize difference. But of course, the traditional leftist idea wasn't just recognizing difference, but it was about the possibility of change and improvement. Okay, and so it isn't just, you know, variation that's valorized, but also the possibility of going from one state to another. Right, one regarded as lower to one regarded as higher. And this is the kind of thing that is being seriously challenged by this kind of renewed effort in human nature. It doesn't say human nature is uniform necessarily, though it does say there are limits. It recognizes variation, but what it does deny is changeability. That is really what the issue is, just how changeable, how much more different can you make people from the way they start off? Okay, and it seems to me this is really quite important. Now, in the history of social science, let's say we go back to the beginning and we look at the establishment of sociology as a discipline and so forth. The establishment of social science, especially if we're talking about people like Durkheim and Weber, is very closely tied with the prominence of the nation state in the history of Europe. And in fact, Emanuel Wallerstein, the historical sociologist, a few years ago convened the Gulbenkian Commission on the Future of the Social Sciences, which he regarded as having a quite dismal future. He's also pessimistic, even though he's pro-social science. He thinks the social sciences, and especially sociology, are artifacts of this major period of nation building, which in a sense really become self-conscious at the end of the 19th century with people like Durkheim and Weber coming of age. Okay, and the point about the nation state is there you have very explicit attempt to construct social entities that have as their design the transformation of people from the way they naturally are. And the way you can track this is through the kinds of rights and obligations associated with citizenship, where citizenship becomes this new artificial kind of identity that one has, right, that entitles you to things, that creates certain expectations about you and so forth, that, as it were, rise above the level of what, say, would be demanded of you from your local community, from your family, in particular, from these kind of spontaneously generated, perhaps quasi-biologically based social arrangements. Okay. I say this because, you know, those of you who know something about the history of sociology know that a very important distinction in founding the field was this distinction that Ferdinand Ternes introduced, Gemeinschaft versus Gesellschaft, community versus society, 1887. And the idea here, the distinction he had in mind, which I think is a very salient one for what we're talking about now, is that the Gemeinschaft, the community, was typically based on family bonds. It had a biological basis to it at the end of the day. Okay, and there's a sense in which if that was all that social life was about, you wouldn't need sociology. You could just have, as it were, a kind of natural history. Families forming in relation to environments and so forth. But what becomes very important and what makes sociology a very distinctive field, okay, that is something more than just the natural history of human beings, the way the 18th century Scottish Enlightenment type people thought about things, for example, is the fact that we've got this thing called the state. We have these artificial social entities which are legally constructed, right? So there's contract relations involved where people voluntarily engage to do activities that will be maintained that are above and beyond what would be normally sanctioned by default social relations. Okay? So typically, right, it enables you to leave your farm or your home to go to the city to get a job, right? I mean, all these kinds of things, right, which in a sense bring people, sort of drag people out of what would be their biologically default positions. And this is very definitive of what sociology is about. It's about those kinds of entities. And if you actually look at a lot of the debates that were brewing in Germany at the time that the German Sociological Association was being established, right, the big bugaboo for these people, the guy who they were really very much against, was Herbert Spencer. Okay? Why? Because Herbert Spencer is your original evolutionary psychologist, basically, right? He's the man whose view of sociology is very much like Steven Pinker's, very much like Peter Singer, very much like these kinds of people we're talking about now, right? Where the idea basically is that there are natural social relations. They are ones that, as it were, are biologically based and have a kind of natural pattern to them and sort of develop in a sort of natural way. And they tend to be relatively small and they tend to be very focused on reproduction and sustenance and things like this. And all the problems in society, according to Spencer, in terms of conflict and so forth, and Spencer's thinking about imperialism here, of course, which he's against, right? Spencer is anti-imperialism. He says, imperialism, all these conflicts that you get between people, come about because there are all these artificially constructed entities, like states, for example, which have these pretenses to being able to do all these wonderful things for people, to make these people, you know, make people into gods and things like this, and it creates all these false expectations that just lead to conflict and undermine the survivability of human beings. So Spencer's kind of a pacifist, okay? Now, we always think about Spencer as, you know, survival of the fittest. But survival of the fittest for Spencer is a natural process. It's the default process. It's not a process that requires human deliberation or something like that. What he's very much against is this business of human beings coming in and thinking that there is some more sophisticated form of conflict that we ought to be engaged in. Right? And so in that respect, he was very much a pacifist. And if you read his writings, right, anti-militarism, anti-imperialist, as opposed to John Stuart Mill, who was an imperialist. because John Stuart Mill has this very ennobling view of human beings and this idea of the white man's burden and all this kind of stuff. Okay, I think this is a very important point to keep in mind here. And John Stuart Mill, I would say, is part of the history of social science in this respect. Because there is this idea of humanity, and this is the kind of point that Turney's was trying to get across with the idea of Gesellschaft, which is something above and beyond just what the default biological relations are of human beings. And that the fact that states are able to do things, they're able to collectivize people in a way that enable accomplishments and achievements that could not be done just by individuals and their small clans and families and so forth, it speaks well to the value of these kinds of arrangements. And so then the task of sociology becomes, how do these things come about? How can they be maintained in the way that has salutary consequences? Okay. So, you know, what Turney's has in the back of his mind isn't really imperialism, but rather things like, you know, the achievements of civilization, right? To be able to have the time, you know, to be able to have the time and space to be able to pursue all the, you know, great things that distinguish human beings from animals, right? So they don't have to worry about somebody breaking into their house all the time and stuff like that, right? You need some very systematic, large-scale kinds of arrangements. You need something that goes well beyond the Hobbesian state of nature. And in fact, not surprisingly, Turney's established his reputation initially as the German translator of Hobbes. Because for him, Hobbes actually was saying something very profound. Because, you know, if you read Hobbes's Leviathan, right, there's a sense in which, you know, Hobbes is saying, look, you need the Leviathan because otherwise you're not going to get the benefits of humanity from that. You need some artificial, large-scale entity, right, that, as it were, can kind of draw people away from what their default tendencies are. Now, as it turns out, Hobbes believes the default tendencies of people are to be afraid of each other and to be combative. Spencer's default views about human beings are somewhat different. He believes human beings, very much like Peter Singer does, are naturally benevolent. But they're benevolent to those around them and who they interact with. Okay? And here I raise an important point about the role of the state here and why the state's been so important. There's a very interesting book out by a guy named Samuel Fleischacker, who's a political philosopher, student of Rawls, and it's on the history of distributive justice. And distributive justice, you might say, is sort of the sociological antidote to benevolence. Okay. Now, benevolence, if you buy this idea of benevolence, and it's an idea that was very much promoted in the Scottish Enlightenment, and it's in Aristotle, and you find it in the Christian tradition as well, and there's this idea of this spontaneous feeling of goodness and goodwill toward others who you can have some kind of sympathetic relationship with. And in fact, it's not just extended to other human beings, but could be extended to animals as well. And Peter Singer talks a lot about this. I mean, in terms of a criterion by which we should be extending rights to animals, right? Can you be benevolent toward them? Can you, you know, sort of get a sense of their feelings and so forth? Okay. Well, the problem that a lot of people came up with, and people like Kant was coming up with this, and Rousseau, starting in the 18th century, one of the things that became very clear was that if you took this idea of benevolence very seriously, it would not be sufficient to actually provide sufficient care for all human beings. Because people aren't benevolent toward everyone or everything. Right? And if you just allowed people to go on the basis of the default benevolent behavior, right, certain kinds of people would be taken care of and other kinds of people would just be left to die. Right? Now, if you're some kind of Darwinian, you have some kind of quasi-Darwinian view about things, that's just normal. Right? In other words, death is normal. And you know, as long as nobody's interfered with the process, that's just the way it goes. Some people are the kind of people who people have attachments to, and others aren't. Too bad if you're not one of those. End of story. Right? But nobody ever expected that benevolence was a kind of universal thing. Now, of course, in Christianity, there's precedence for thinking about a universal sense of care. Okay? And what the state does, what people like Kant and Rousseau and Condorcet and people like that started arguing at the end of the 18th century was that there's a sense in which one wants to secularize that sentiment and make this kind of what the state's about. And the way, and so in other words, you want to have concern for people beyond those that you have any kind of immediate, empathic kind of feeling for. And moreover, it's not just those people, but also thinking in terms of future generations of people, people who you can imagine but who you actually don't have any connection to. Right? Getting that kind of mentality as part of the sphere within which moral concern and justice, you're not going to get that just from evolutionary psychology. You're going to have some kind of constructed vision of things. And this is where the concept of distributive justice starts to get some purchase. And the way it's understood, and this is where Kant, I think, is a very important thinker in this regard, is it's regarded as a form of resistance to the natural tendency. Right? If you know anything about Kant, one thing you'll know is that Kant's view about morals and ethics, his idea of autonomy in particular, is one that is defined almost entirely in terms of resistance of the passions. In other words, you do things because you know they're right, not because they're the easiest thing to do, because you'd like to do them, or anything of that sort. In fact, if those are the reasons, then there's something probably suspect about what you're doing. So the idea is there's this expectation that what's right is going to somehow be resistant to the passions. Now, this idea for Kant and all the rest, you know, goes back to a kind of Calvinist kind of thing, where original sin is always the default position for you, and the biological is identified with the sinful, and so therefore, if you're going to really be this fully Christianized human being, you've got to kind of resist that, right? That's kind of the or thing going on with Kant. But the point is, that's quite, for Kant, that's very important in terms of what's being promoted as distributive justice, and what the role of the state is to instill this attitude at a systematic level as part of what it is to be a citizen. And of course, the way this gets institutionalized most clearly, you know, is through things like taxation, right? You're obliged to pay taxes, which then get redistributed and help those who are less well off. Most of the beneficiaries of your taxes you'll never meet, right? And that's a very crucial part of the equation. And throughout the 19th century, you get people, especially John Stuart Mill, pushing this line as well, okay, as being what's very distinctive. Now, somebody like Spencer is very much against this. Not because he wants, you know, not because he's a cruel guy, but because he sees this whole idea of trying to go against default passions, go against natural tendencies, as just a sort of Sisyphus, right? Where you're pushing the rock up, you're trying to sort of go beyond something that's natural, and it's just going to come back down on you, right? And this idea that somehow going against human nature is ultimately going to undermine you, right, is one that, of course, Spencer doesn't need Darwin for. You can get this directly from Thomas Malthus, who Darwin also draws on. Right, if you note Malthus's essay on population, which in a sense provides the kind of template for the idea of natural selection, right, which basically says, look, death is natural. There's a sense in which, you know, don't mystify it on the one hand by thinking there's some reason why people die. But on the other hand, you know, so that's like the religious thing, right? Oh, somebody just died. What did they do that was wrong, right? Don't worry about that issue. But on the other hand, don't start getting some fancy medical science in there trying to prolong the lives of people, or some fancy welfare scheme that puts taxes in to keep these people artificially going through subsidies or something, because they can't fend for themselves, and all it's going to do is create this enormous tax burden that's going to sort of drain the productivity of your country. This was Malthus is writing Essay on Population, 1798, against the poor laws, which are sort of the prototype of sort of welfare policy, right, in Britain. Okay, so you've got, you know, so this kind of thing here, right, my point here is that this kind of sensibility is feeding into evolutionary psychology and sociobiology and all these latter-day revivals of human nature. Of course, nobody likes to raise the name Malthus or even Spencer, because this kind of has all kinds of unsavory connotations in light of history. But nevertheless, that is kind of what's being tapped into here in a more sophisticated version, certainly in terms of what the political consequences are. It's not so different, right? So it gets used to show why welfare policies fail, for example, and why we shouldn't be trying so hard and so forth. Okay. Now, my point about bringing up Tierney's and the Gesellschaft stuff is because social science was very much tied to the project of these artificial social entities that go beyond the sort of default family biological relations being kind of the thing that really defines what human beings are about. Okay, and that the and it's not surprising, it's not accidental, that so much of the history of social science, especially sociology, has revolved around functions of the nation state. You know, if you think about what structural functionalism was about, the way it divided up society, it was basically various state functions, which one would have like departments or, you know, it's kind of like a bureaucratic view of what a society is. And so this is not surprising because in a sense this was kind of part of what was always in the project. Okay. And indeed, the kinds of entities that sociologists traditionally studied, in the beginning at least, right, were things not only like states, but also things like religions. I mean, we tend to underestimate the degree, you know, but of course if we look at people like Durkheim and Weber, religion is a very important part of what they're studying. And why are they studying this? Well, one of the important reasons why they're studying it is because these things have long-term historical continuity, which managed to get that managed collectively to create enormous amount of consequences in the world, but nevertheless the form of transmission for the most part is not biological. In other words, the recruits, the modes of succession and so forth, right, is through conversion, through election, through examination, that is to say through non-biological artificial means. And that's quite significant, and that you can have these major kind of social formations that continue as long as they do. And of course science could be included as one such example as well, in terms of the way in which scientific knowledge gets transmitted. It is not transmitted biologically, either in the literal sense of through the genes, or even through the, you know, kind of the more, you know, phenotypic sense of, you know, having dynasties of scientists and so forth, okay? And this is quite important, that this kind of thing works, that you're able to have modes of succession that have long-term efficacious results for human beings that are not biologically transmitted primarily. Again, you might think this is really obvious, but if you actually look at what evolutionary psychologists and sociobiologists write about social life, they operate on the assumption that in fact the family, right, these biologically based relations where there's exchange of genes going on, is kind of the building block from which all other social formations happen, and that social formations that in a sense cannot be derived that way in some straightforward fashion, right, if they don't work or if they run into problems, it's because there's some sense in which they're illegitimate biologically. And my point is that the social sciences, especially sociology, have been predicated on the idea that there are robust modes of succession that are not biologically based, that in a sense can defy this kind of biological mode of transmission. Okay. And that most of our ideas about welfare and social progress and so forth have been predicated on that as well. Okay. And so this is, I think, one of the things that's kind of up for grabs here. Now, how much, I mean, I know I've been going on for about 50 minutes. How much more time do you think I should go on?
About 10 minutes.
Okay. One thing I haven't talked about yet, I've only talked in a sense about one part of the story, but as you know, the kind of people who tend to defend the kind of old-style sociology, I mean, I don't know about how this department works, but our department, right, the first-year sociology course, there's a lot of business about Marx, Weber, and Durkheim, right? The Holy Trinity. You know, it's as if, you know, all these late 19th century guys kind of set the basis for everything that's going on now. And, you know, of course, the first years who don't know anything, this could be impressive. But, of course, you know, for people who actually work doing social research and so forth, and even for sophisticated undergraduates, right, there is something very weird about, you know, these 19th century guys somehow being the foundation for understanding this world in which we live, which is so radically different from what was going on when Marx, Weber, and Durkheim were writing. You know, and so how do you square that, right? And of course, there are all kinds of ways of finessing this, and I don't have to remind you of them. But the point is that the credibility of this as a kind of foundation for the field is undermined by, certainly the younger generation don't find this as persuasive as the older generation do. And what I want to do, in the conclusion here, is to talk about the ways in which this kind of view of social science as being concerned with a notion of society that in a sense transcends the biological, how this has become undermined through this kind of pincer attack from both the humanities and the natural sciences. If I had to characterize the way in which it's been undermined by the natural sciences, in the way sort of summarizing all this stuff I've been talking about, the biological side of the issue, I would say what you've got here with evolutionary psychology and sociobiology is this kind of blurring of species boundaries. I mean, this thing is already present in Darwin on the morphological level, right? Namely, the degree to which one can talk about there being similarities between things that animals do in their environment with what humans do. But of course, as genetics started to kick in the 20th century, right, we actually have massive genetic overlap across species. So the idea of distinguishing between one species and another is a kind of conventional distinction, typically having to do with whether reproduction produces fertile offspring. There are these kind of rough and ready kinds of distinctions. But the general picture that you get is that life is this massive overlapping gene pool, and there's a kind of by convention, but nothing more than that, one can say this is the human bit. Okay? So there's a sense in which blurring of species boundaries is kind of what happens on the biological side, and what the consequence of that is that then you start becoming a little more liberal about the way in which to understand human beings. Maybe studying an ape isn't such a bad idea, especially that the more we study apes, the more intelligent they seem to become, no doubt because we come up with better ways of studying them, right? So there's this kind of reciprocity going on here, which kind of continues to blur the boundaries, species boundaries there. But there's also the humanistic side of the story, which I haven't talked about too much, but I think this is very much part of it and dovetails very well. And I think this is one of the reasons why in fields like science studies in a way is very comfortable with a lot of the stuff that I'm talking about. And this is the post-structuralist turn, okay? If you go back to the 1960s and 70s, where you start to get issues of the death of the author, the death of the subject, right, Roland Barthes and Michel Foucault, and if you talk about the early Michel Foucault, and we're talking about The Order of Things, 1966 in French, right, I mean, what is this book about? Well, this book is in a way a godsend to somebody like Steven Pinker, right, because this is a book that basically says that man, right, you know, the object man, right, has passed its sell-by date, right, and that basically it was really only, it only existed, right, starting, you know, 1795 when Kant writes a book called Anthropology, okay, and is basically dying a slow but clear death in the 20th century, right? That's what this book's about, okay? And what it's tracking is kind of the mentality behind the book is that the human sciences, right, which we can take for purposes of this argument, the social sciences, is kind of a blip on the screen of history. Right? And it arose through a rather fortuitous combination of events within natural history, within political economy, within philology, right? If you recall that book, those are the three main things that come to play at the end of the 18th century, and you get what Foucault calls the echoing Kant, right, man as the empirical transcendental doublet, right, where you get this kind of coherent thing stuck together. Because in the past, right, let's say you think about Descartes. We go back 150 years from Kant, and if you're looking at Descartes, right, Descartes's not interested, for Descartes, man is kind of a messy thing, right? Because what he's concerned, so when he's concerned about knowledge and thinking and all that stuff that we associate him with, he's concerned about, right, the spiritual side, the intellectual side, and all that material stuff that happens to attach to us. Well, that can drag us down, and we need to understand how that works. But that's not really the stuff that really interests us. Right, and that's actually a very common view throughout the history of philosophy up to Kant, where there's a sense in which you don't treat human beings as kind of integral entities in their own right. You tend to focus, right, on the spiritual mental part, and then you treat the physical part as kind of a drag or an inconvenience or something that gets in the way. But with Kant, you start to get this idea that it's all part of a package. And so Kant's anthropology is about actually how living in different cultures determines the kind of person you are. And there you get one of the earliest systematic reportings in the modern period of all the prejudices and stereotypes that people have of other cultures. I mean, that thing book's a total embarrassment, right? From that standard, it's not a politically correct book by our standards. But that's where you get this idea of the human being as this kind of integral entity has to be understood in the whole, the body and the soul, as one thing. And that's what Foucault, and then Foucault says, you know, in the 19th century, of course, you start to get all the various social sciences developing, each of which think of human beings or their combinations as having some kind of unique ontological status that then is subject to a science, sets of laws, things of that kind. But then it all starts to fall apart again in the beginning of the 20th century, and Freud is the big culprit, and of course Nietzsche, and even to a certain extent Marx, given that there is, given the massiveness of false consciousness, right, in some sense that, you know, we respond to an environment that in a way is really false, and so that we're sort of torn apart. So this idea of having sort of a you know, self-alienation, right, again, looks like it's splitting apart the human being. Okay, and what Foucault is saying, basically, this is what, you know, we're just going to go back to the way things were originally, where, you'll basically have these beings that, in a sense, vary amongst themselves, but don't have any kind of ontological integrity of their own. And it seems to me that, of course, people who sort of live under the sign of Foucault, as it were, right, and take that Foucault thing seriously, right, have no problem with this. So if you look at all this business of hybridized identities and cyborgs and all this kind of stuff, right, this business of melding the human and the non-human that's so popular in science studies now, all of this is very much part of, you know, this is kind of the consequence of this. And, it, you know, so it's not just Foucault, but a lot of other thinkers have been moving in this direction as well. And this is very consonant, at a metaphysical level at least, with the kind of thing that you're seeing with evolutionary psychology and sociobiology. But in both cases, what's happening is you're obliterating sort of the integrity of the social as a distinctly human thing that had been previously regarded as the grounds for having something called social science. So this is kind of the challenge that we're facing here in the 21st century, and maybe this is a convenient point to stop the talk. How about that? Giving you the challenge right there.
Thank you very much for that. Sorry, my throat's gone dry. Can I open the floor to questions or comments, please? Right, you saw it. Okay. Sorry, please go.
I think about an alternative way of framing your original question, which is, I mean, I guess the simplistic response to thinker and so on is to say, well, this is a challenge not, as it were, to the very conception, as you were presenting it, but a challenge in to the extent of how right or wrong they are. I mean, so that a lot of the social conscious ones become challenged by saying, well, that's an interesting idea, but it's wrong because of this kind of evidence or that kind of thing. Whereas, as it were, you're offering it as a paradigm or a foundational kind of thing. So what's wrong with that other kind of challenge?
No, that's true, and in fact, if it would be nice if more social scientists actually did that. I mean, and this raises an interesting kind of sociological point about the degree to which this literature gets engaged with by social scientists. Because as you probably know, right, social scientists have a very take it or leave it attitude toward evolutionary psychology or sociobiology. Right, they either believe it, say, yes, finally somebody's talking sense in social science, right. Or they say, look, this stuff's just rubbish, right? And indeed, you know, I mean, one of the things that I think, if you want to engage in this kind of trench warfare, as it were, with people like Pinker, you know, so criticizing him on his exact claims about particular things, is that you should follow his footnotes. This is true of E.O. Wilson and the rest of them, because what they tend to do is they actually tend to rely on social science research. But what they do is they sort of treat the data as kind of neutral, so stripped of method and stripped of theory. But that was used to actually gather and analyze the data. They just then aggregate it all, you know, and then, you know, provide this kind of covering explanation. And so from a methodological standpoint, you could have a field day with this stuff. And I'm in fact very surprised that social scientists don't do that, get into the sort of trenches of their footnotes. Because they're often citing studies from psychology, anthropology, sociology, but aggregated, you know, in this very weird kind of way, you know, so you know, basically studies that operate with totally different assumptions are just being made to, you know, stand for the same conclusion that then gets explained by the same thing. And so, yeah, and not only that, of course, cross-species they do this. I mean, that's the other thing, right? We're just talking about human beings here. But, of course, these guys will also do cross-species aggregations. So research done on different species, right? Imagine all the differences that could be involved there methodologically, and then doing a kind of covering explanation on that. Exactly. But what's striking is that you don't see social scientists really doing that in any kind of systematic way. In fact, the tendency tends to be to sort of think, wow, finally, there's some, you know, there's some guys with the, you know, with the nerve to actually try to systematize stuff. You know, because what they're, you know, what a lot of these social scientists think is, oh, social science is just a wash in relativism, and it's about time we got some, you know, some guys come in there and try to really, you know, organize this stuff and give some kind of general theory.
Okay, can I leave then?
Mm-hmm.
There are about 35 questions I want to ask.
Oh, we will. So obviously, given no one's putting their hands up.
Yeah. I'll try and confine myself to one thing. Right. Specifically in relation to Pinker, I had an experience the other day. A good friend of mine, who I've always thought of as a reasonable human being, said to me, "My God, have you read this? You must have read this. Isn't it brilliant? I'm going to like this."
There you go.
And he is, in fact, the historian. What I want to ask is basically, why do you think this stuff is so seductive? Even to people like my friend, who's a historian, who is a sensible person, as I said, who knows how social scientists operate, why is it so seductive? Why is it so appealing?
Well, because I think this literature actually makes a lot of claims for getting at things like human nature, getting at very sort of basic things that often motivate, especially people in the humanities, to do kind of the research they do, right? They may not think that their disciplines are going to be the ones to actually come up with the theories, but they're hoping somebody's going to come up with theories that they will find somewhat plausible. And if you look at, you know, you look at philosophy, you look at the social sciences, everybody's dropping the ball on this, right? They don't want to get involved in making substantive, large-scale claims. I mean, in a sense, it's kind of a backlash against post-structuralism and against a lot of this kind of relativism. Right, and I think that's especially for people who were not involved in the original debates that established the sort of kind of hegemony that relativism has now in the social sciences. If you're not actually part of those debates, if you're somewhat younger, right, you know, and you know, you're sort of thinking, wow, why aren't people asking these big questions? Why aren't they trying to come up with some kind of, you know, big theory to explain things? And people like Pinker and Wilson, they're happy to give you a theory. So there's at least something there on the table. They're willing to say there's an issue, right? I mean, because you know what it's like when you deal with a lot of relativists and deconstructivists and things like that. All the questions that you might have thought were interesting and big, they just deflate them, demystify them, dismiss them, you know, and you just sort of feel empty at the end. And so unless you're one of these people who feels relieved by having a kind of Zen experience of not having to worry about big questions anymore because they don't really matter, right, it seems it's very unsatisfying. It just seems purely negative. And here you got guys who are actually saying something quite positive in a way, right? They're giving you a positive story, and one that it claims to be putting together lots of different things. So it could be at just basically that level. Because remember, all these books that we're talking about here are best-selling books. They're not just books that are, you know, being discussed by academics and academic journals, but these are popular works, right? So there's something that is, they're appealing to something there. And I think this idea of human nature has not gone away, and we've got to come, and as social scientists, we've got to come to grips with it in a way that goes beyond just demystifying and deconstructing and dismissing it, if we want to really be competitive with these people.
Okay, can I keep going with this? Go on.
Well, see, okay. I think you're raising a good point here. I mean, the issue of let's go back. You know, I mentioned one of the things I mentioned in the talk was this issue of benevolence. You know, having this feeling for people, right? This kind of spontaneous feeling of care and concern for people, right? This is quite a characteristic. This kind of feeling, right? And indeed, feelings and sentiments and so forth. Of this kind of spontaneous, as you would say, natural kind, is the kind of stuff that these people like to explain, right? Especially because they think you can see this cross-culturally, right? Expressed in many different cultures that otherwise have a lot of differences in terms of language, in terms of the way they're organized, stuff like that. And so they're trying to find some kind of, you might say, direct route in the genes or in the combination of genes with environment, right, that can nevertheless explain these kinds of sensuous feelings. So there's an attempt to actually bring the two things together with these particular kinds of biologists are. And in fact, the seductiveness of that is, of course, the unmediated nature of it. Because, see, a social scientist will say, right, all the actions in the mediation, right, it's in the way the society structures the sentiment and the way it gets channeled and expressed and all that. But here these guys are saying, look, yeah, that can all be true, but at the end of the day you have these fundamental feelings that are cross-culturally demonstrable, and there's this common biological basis. And sure, there may be all this mediation in the middle, but there are these two endpoints, the ultimate cause and the ultimate effect. And so in a sense, then, that's where the biology ends up explaining the nature. You see, and that's the story. That's the story that they want to tell. And I think one of the things that social scientists, and this is where I was talking about the role of the state and all that in here, is that part of what social science, in a way, has been about has been looking at the ways in which people develop ways of counteracting their immediate sensations, their immediate feelings, their spontaneous reactions. That's been very much part of what, you know, when we talk about socialization, right, in the Talcott Parsons way, that is kind of what we're talking about, right? In a sense, trying to countermand or counteract those spontaneous things and not putting such a great value on them, you see? Like one of the popular topics now among evolutionary psychologists is disgust, right? And, you know, Martha Nussbaum's now written this whole book, denouncing all this, right? Good for her, I would say, you know, even though she's kind of like a Victorian prude, but nevertheless, that's often the kind of person you need, I mean, for times like this. But the point is, like, disgust is a great example of something evolutionary biologists love to explain, right? Because it's spontaneous. It's the kind of thing that society often has things to tell you, you know, it's not politically correct to sneer at poor people or something like this, right? But nevertheless, they like to go back to that because they think, well, that's the fundamental thing. Plus, from a social science standpoint, that's just raw material, right? Your spontaneous responses are the things you start with, but then you try to transform them or, you know, as Freud would say, sublimate them, you know, do something beyond them. And it's through that process of transformation of the spontaneous natural reaction that you actually manufacture human beings. And that's the point, I think, that we social scientists have to get back on the table, that human beings are manufactured. They're not natural. Right? There's nothing natural about being a human being. Okay? And from that standpoint, right, this is where the human nature issue, that's the way you countermand it. You say, look, human nature is a contradiction in terms. If you're human, you're not natural. You've in some way transformed in a really radical way the natural. And that's the line we ought to be pushing more consistently. I think that's very much true to the history of social science in terms of what it's been traditionally concerned with.
Can I just ask, given what you've said there and before, in terms of, I mean, obviously we all recognise, okay, discourse in caught in the headlights of evolutionary science and human genome projects and everything of that nature. Is that then what you just said, how we need, because you before you said we need to beat these people at that, but that to my mind is much more complementarity than actually winning the debate. Why can these two things not win?
Well, you see, you bring up the Human Genome Project, it complicates this whole story in a very interesting kind of way. Because people like Pinker and E.O. Wilson and all these people who are on the sort of evolutionary psychology, sociobiology front, they don't talk much about kind of the designs that people who fund those kinds of projects have, right? Because if you think about, you know, why is Human Genome Project such a big deal? Well, pharmaceutical companies, all kinds of genetic enhancements and, you know, cyborgization. You know, people have all these kinds of views about how human beings can be improved in some way by manipulating genes and stuff of that kind, right? So there is this kind of, this very sort of proactive kind of agenda that's really motivating a lot of that stuff. That kind of issue, right, doesn't really figure in the sort of stuff that we're talking about here. And if you look at Richard Dawkins, it's the same way. And people like Peter Singer, they don't really stress the biotechnology side of these developments. They're much more on the natural history side, you might say. Even though they're doing experimental science very often, they're thinking about this as finding out what human beings are really like in some kind of essential, you know, way, or at least ways in which we can't really change. So in that sense, the spirit of that enterprise is very much opposed to the kinds of things that motivate people to want to be funding the Human Genome Project. Okay, and I think, in a sense, that much that social scientists could do a lot exploiting that kind of division within the ranks, because I think it would be a mistake to think that all of these kinds of biologically oriented people are in fact singing from the same hymn sheet. They're not, right? I mean, people like Pinker and Singer and Dawkins and Wilson and even Stephen Jay Gould, even though they have different kinds of views about what human beings can be, they're thinking about it largely outside of the context of biotechnological enhancement. Right? They're thinking about it pretty much in terms of what you can find about the nature of people understood in that kind of pure science way. But if you bring in all this biotechnology, and then you add the prosthesis and all the other stuff that people want to add in to turn us into cyborgs, that's getting us into a different space, right? Which in a way does contradict the natural history approach of the people I've been talking about. So I think, you know, that's something that's worth exploring a little bit more. I mean, there's an interesting historical precedent for this. I always, you know, if you want to have a kind of a model for thinking about this, if you look at, you know, Thomas Henry Huxley, the guy who was Darwin's bulldog, right? He was a surgeon, medical man, and he gave this famous Romaine's lecture in 1893 on evolution and ethics, which was basically meant as a kind of a sort of refutation of Spencer's view. Spencer being very much like our evolutionary psychologists are now. And Huxley was basically talking about this issue that I've been bringing up, namely that to be a human being is to resist the natural tendencies of evolution. It's one thing to understand what they are and to admit that they're there and that they in fact explain, you know, how things have developed, but it's another thing just to think of them as default positions that we can't do anything about. Okay? And Huxley's example of how we in fact manage to take control of the situation is medicine. Right, even though in the Victorian period, you know, it's still relatively primitive. But this is the kind of guy, you know, who I think, you know, if he were alive now, would use the biotechnology stuff that's happening as a foil against this kind of stuff that says, well, you know, you have to lower your policy expectations because human beings are just kind of the way they are. Right, so there's a sense in which there are these two different issues here. And I must admit, I am surprised that there isn't more explicit conflict between the evolutionists and the medical community. Because it seems to me that their orientations are really quite different. People who are concerned about extending life expectancy into the infinity, like a lot of these medical people are, go very much against the spirit of what evolution is talking about, where extinction and death is quite a natural thing, and if you try to stop it, you're going to run into ecological problems down the line. You see, I mean, it seems to me that there is a real natural tension here in terms of the regulative ideals of these supposedly both biological disciplines that could be exploited more by social scientists.
I want to ask a question, but you can do it. Where?
So just on that point that you mentioned up there, I think one has to bear in mind that from Darwin to at least the early 20th century, most evolutionists were Lamarckian.
Mm-hmm.
And then since then, there's always some way of being Lamarckian without quite being Lamarckian, of somehow allowing for cultural changes to be solidified biologically. And in The Defense of Man, Darwin himself says, he raises just the question you raised. You know, does it follow from my view that we ought not to take care of the poor and to not take care of the sick? And he says, in a very kind of 18th century, on balance, on balance we do more harm to ourselves than good because we won't develop what's best in our nature and we won't pass that on. So at least he didn't think it followed from his view that you have to stop taking care of the sick. But my question, Steve, was about the more recent developments and whether you think there's any mileage to be got from looking at the recent dominance of biological thinking about the social, or the evaporation of the social into the biological. Not so much in terms of the three great branches of knowledge, the humanities, the social sciences, and the natural sciences, but rather jockeying within the social sciences. I mean, might there be a case made for seeing what's happened recently as the revenge of physical anthropology on the rest? And my impression is that for a long time, the anthropologists were the ones that skulked around in the social science department because they were the ones that were really, they stood for the bad old days. They were kind of vestigial. And a lot of the anthropologists, people like Cosmides and Toomey, they're anthropologists.
Yeah.
And Pinker was a convert to
verify, but in the first instance, the driving force here is anthropology, which is one of the social sciences.
Yeah, except, okay, but there I think you get an interesting, because with the decline of imperialism, okay, and the which in a sense provided kind of the natural market for a lot of the expansion of anthropology departments in the 20th century, okay, there's a sense in which the prior dominance of something like social and cultural anthropology just starts to shrink, or and then the people who want to still be involved in that migrate to cultural studies and other safer havens, and so what's left then are these guys. Right, and these guys got the space to themselves, okay, and I think that and what they're doing is they're finding kind of new alliances to be able to maintain their existence, and for them, right, they physical anthropology was always kind of a borderline area, with biology anyway, so it seems to me that they're just sort of, in order to given this changing, because anthropology is a dying subject overall, and if it's going to and if people are interested in that area are going to survive. Right, the ones, you'll get people going to cultural studies, the social and cultural guys, but the physical guys will go into this evolutionary psychology stuff and its aligned fields. I think that's what's happening. Basically, anthropology is dying.
But it's much stronger than that, though, in the States. I mean, the anthropologists and the primatologists that I've interviewed working in the States have discussed this split, not as a kind of gradual parting of the ways, but an explicit struggle for what is allowed to constitute the soul of anthropology.
Yeah, but there are fewer and fewer departments of the subject. I mean, if you look at, as it were, the reproductive patterns of this discipline, anthropology, right, there are fewer students going into it at the PhD level, departments are disappearing. I mean, I think this is, if you want to talk about dying fields, it seems to me that's a field in a downward trajectory. And I just think people are just basically going to where they think they can survive effectively. So yeah, maybe it's manifesting itself at the moment at the, at the professional conferences, but the professional conferences, are going to matter less and less as time goes on, I think, for that
particular
field.
You're not so much at the professional conferences. Within the actual departments themselves, what you're seeing are departments of anthropology in the States splitting, actually physically splitting, with anthropology, some people keeping the term anthropology for the cultural studies side of it, with biology, with the biological anthropologists pissing off biology, others with the anthropological, others where the sort of tag of anthropology remains with the physical anthropologist.
Yeah, no, I don't deny this, but I just think that one has to look at this as part of a larger trajectory about how the discipline, because that is, of all the social science disciplines, that may be the one that's actually in most marked decline, in terms of, if you look in terms of PhDs, Derek DeSola Price always used to talk, he used to think about disciplines as kind of organisms and the reproductive patterns, how many PhDs are being reproduced to keep the field alive for another generation. That's the field that's doing the worst in the social sciences.
Right, the question that I actually wanted to ask was to go back to something that you said at the beginning of the talk, which was about the distinction that you were drawing between these three sort of trends, the humanities, social sciences, and sciences. And the thing that you were saying about the social sciences was that they are one of the few, what made the social sciences social was the fact they actually went out and connected with people and got the data from interacting with individual people, whether that be quantitative or qualitative. And I guess what I was thinking about in relation to that was, when I've interviewed primatologists and talked to them about popular accounts of primatology, popular accounts of evolutionary psychology, popular accounts of sociobiology, what they've been extraordinarily concerned to do, even those who actually write popular accounts themselves, is to keep that line between the popular accounts, which they consider to be dangerous in many ways, not dangerous because it might sort of, dangerous because of the inaccurate picture which it gives of the state of biological knowledge and the state of knowledge about the biological origins of human beings, right? And they will talk quite explicitly about the fact that, they find it terrifying coming into a class and sort of seeing all these students who are absolutely so signed up to this idea, to the ideals of evolutionary psychology. And they explicitly try to teach the student, no, you can't follow this line, it doesn't work out in practice, it's a nice idea, but it's the phenotypic gambit and we can't prove it yet. And I was just wondering whether or not, given that, again, primatology is a field of science, and you have primatologists, if not interacting with individual primates, you have them actually going out and making contact with whole animals living in the real world.
No, true. I mean, I So what is your question primarily about?
I guess my question is kind of like a reflection on the point that you were making about social sciences.
Well, of course, within the more sort of ecologically and ecologically oriented
I'm trying to sort of
natural
work back that, you know, there are many crossovers between these. What I'm trying to get at is that I'm trying to make a point, I guess, that the situation might be a bit more subtle than you suggest necessarily in the talk.
Yeah, but the point is, if you think you're going to be making conclusions about human beings by looking at apes, no matter how you know.
But that's the point. That's not what that's.
No, that's what they say. Okay, that's what they say. But I mean, you. I think from what you've described, you're talking to some fairly purist guys. Okay, because there are other folks, especially folks who have to rely on contracts and stuff like that, who actually find the popularization stuff incredibly good because it provides a kind of. It gives a sense of a larger purchase of this kind of stuff.
Right, in the grant thing.
Yeah,
when you
write
the grants, this is what you say you're going to do. When you write the popular books, this is what you say you're going to do. But that's not what you're actually doing when you're out there.
Yeah, but then you can't really condemn the popular. I mean, okay, maybe they're condemning it to you, right, and saying that, you know, I'm really a pure guy at heart, you know. But the point is, they're not really condemning. I mean, you don't get. So, for example, I mean, you know, to shift it a little bit, look at Richard Dawkins. Okay, Richard Dawkins is a guy who makes all kinds of, you know, really exaggerated claims very often about what evolution shows and so forth. And do you see, you know, Stephen Jay Gould aside, there is no real condemnation from that community. There's not a lot of controversy. I mean, people tolerate that kind of stuff because they know he's great public relations. Right? All these people are just excellent public relations at the end of the day. And sure, they can tell you in an interview, well, you know, I don't really believe that very exaggerated stuff. But not really trying to stop it, are they?
Neither are we.
What do you mean, neither are we? Oh, that's the problem. Well, that is a problem. That's a problem with us, yes. And not only are we not trying to stop it, but also, I think we're not, I mean, I think actually better than trying to stop it, because people should be entitled, you know, if the biologists want to turn this into a worldview, God bless them. But I think we should be having our own alternatives out there. And that's the thing that I find very disappointing, that social scientists aren't any social science Richard Dawkins. Right, that there aren't those kinds of people out there. That's what I find very disappointing. So that it ends up that very often, you know, in the past, Stephen Jay Gould was basically making argument, you know, making the kind, you know, social scientists would cite Stephen Jay Gould as the guy who answered Dawkins. They would never make an argument themselves. And in fact, this is one of the real big problems with the way the social scientists deal with this literature. They consider themselves spectators on everything. They don't study enough of the biology to be able to make substantive contributions to the discussions themselves. They don't go into the detail of the research sufficiently. And what they do instead is that they rely on the testimony of the biological opponents to these guys like Dawkins or Pinker and so forth. So Stephen Jay Gould gets cited a lot, or Richard Lewontin, right? People of that kind will get cited a lot, and say, or Stephen Rose, right? And they say, oh, look, those guys said X. They said that this biological stuff is rubbish. Therefore, it must be rubbish, you know, and end of story. So the social scientists don't actually participate in the debate. They just believe what some other biologist says. And it seems to me, given that what all these biologists are talking about is their own turf, you know, this is, you know, borderline scandalous, right? And it's a very disappointing feature about this. And in a way, I sometimes think that people like Stephen Rose, and Lewontin and Gould, they end up having a very perverse effect on the discussion because, in a sense, they can give the false impression social scientists can sleep well at night. Because, you know, here's Stephen Jay Gould saying, well, you know, the time span required for evolutionary change to occur is much larger than anything that social scientists are concerned about, so don't worry about any of those genetic arguments. And social scientists say, hey, that sounds good. I'm not going to have to worry about Richard Dawkins anymore. Well, sorry. I mean, meanwhile, there's the great public out there and the policymakers, and if there is no substantive counter-argument, right, that is the positive view on the table. And it's amazing social scientists aren't more proactive. I don't think they should be stopping what Dawkins says. They should just be there arguing against him in person, not just through some biological surrogate.
I think we've come to the end of the discussion period, unless anybody has anything that they desperately want to ask. Right? Okay. Well, before I actually thank Steve for that discussion, I can point out that we're all heading down the pub, or at least some of us are heading down the pub.